What's up, y'all? Welcome. I'm Judge.
That was what's so up? Casual.
What's up?
What's up, y'all?
What's up, y'all?
It's like you're doing late night radio.
Welcome to Warm 94.9.
Exactly.
This is Smooth Jazz, the music for your ears. I don't know. I don't know how to do this. Welcome to another episode of American They Seize Hour, continuing an award-winning season about health and wellness. I'm Arjun.
I'm Akash.
I'm thrilled about today's episode. I've talked about this a lot. You guys have heard me. I talk about it a lot. I'm a very proud therapy goer.
Yeah.
Very proud of the mental health work I have done on myself. And I want to share why. I was somebody that was struggling. There were so many obstacles that were coming. For me, it was very much about relationships, where I just couldn't seem to get out of my own way. I just kept putting roadblocks and roadblocks in front of myself that would mess me up. And honestly, I kept spiraling out of control in my head about overthinking, beating myself up, the level of insecurities I was having. And a friend of mine finally said to me, listen, I don't think this is great. Maybe you need some help. And so I sought it out, and it's been the best decision I've ever made. I've been in therapy since 2010. A little bit of a break in the middle. And someone put it to me in the way that I really love, you know, you exercise your body. Why wouldn't you exercise your mind?
Right.
You know? And another way I heard about it that really resonated for me is who you are is like a house.
Right.
And you walk in, and if you don't have the awareness, if you're struggling, if you walk in, it's dark.
Right.
Well, why don't you, like, if you have a therapist or you have someone that helps in this way, a life coach or whatever it might form to be, that's somebody that helps you turn on the lights.
Right, right.
And that's what I've been able to do over the last several years. And I'm in a wonderful and healthy relationship now that I'm so grateful to be a part of.
Look at that big announcement.
I slipped it in the last week's episode. I don't think it would have been possible because I was in such... I just was not allowing myself to be treated the way I deserved.
Right.
I wasn't able to find what I really wanted. But it's just beyond that. Now my relationship with my family.
Right.
My relationship with my father has, like, the way we talk to each other, I understand him better because we're able to, our lines of communications are open more because I can identify things. I can say, hey, this is what I'm struggling with, Dad. I'm learning how to speak with people. I feel like I've become a better human. I, like, understand how to be a human better.
Yeah.
And I know I'm monologuing right now, it's just because this is truly like an incredibly deep-seated passion for me. We want this out there because I don't know that people are that healthy. Like, life is uncontrollable, life is crazy, and I want people to either seek help when they need it or just find ways that they can enjoy life and thrive. I want people to be able to thrive. There's a Marianne Williamson quote, our deepest fear is not that we are inadequate. Our deepest fear is that we are powerful beyond measure. As we unlock our light, we unconsciously allow others to unlock theirs. I want everyone to unlock their light. Because it's, and as I'm closer to that light being on more and more, it is fabulous. Life is fun. I'm enjoying things. I'm full of gratitude. I'm full of, like, the right friends. I have the right community that, like, love and support me and have my back. Akash is laughing at me because I'm just, this is a monologue.
Then you're not even done.
I'm not done
yet. Of a 5-minute intro.
I'm not letting you talk yet. Okay, here's the real reason that we have everybody on. See, me talking too much is such a point of contention in our relationship. We've actually only brought on a psychiatrist, would you call yourself a psychotherapist?
Psychiatrist
to do couples counseling. He's actually been sitting here this entire time.
Yeah.
Just sitting
here.
I wanted him to see this.
We
needed to see so that we could know just how deep-rooted this issue
Look
is.
Look how far apart we're sitting on this couch
I mean,
right now. Look at the distance in this relationship.
I will hug you.
Caused by his verboseness.
More than 45 minutes.
I will hug you right now, brother. We brought on another person within the mental health industry. This is we talked to the transplant psychiatrist, and now we have on Naveen Dargani. What I hope is to just talk to us about how we can deal better with our mental health and what we can all do. But before we do that, I want to introduce him. Naveen Dargani is a psychiatrist who specializes in treating anxiety, depression, and OCD with a combination of psychotherapy and medications. While pursuing his master's in public health at SUNY Downstate, Naveen also focused on immigrant health. Between that and his extensive experience working in some of New York's most diverse neighborhoods, he is very comfortable working with people's mental health concerns as they present in various social and cultural contexts. He also serves as medical director of Lexington Mental Health Services, which provides culturally competent mental health care to NYC's deaf community. Naveen, welcome to the show. Thank you for being here. And thank you for listening to my monologue.
It's a pleasure to be here.
First of all, you could have told him to shut up. We get it, bro. We get it.
I don't know him that well
you
yet.
You could have said it on my behalf. So you called yourself a psychiatrist, from my understanding is that is pretty different than psychology, which is what I would have associated psychotherapy with. Aren't psychology and psychotherapy essentially the same thing? And psychiatry something different?
So it's an interesting question that I get a lot. Basically, a psychiatrist is someone who has gone to medical school, so an MD, usually, and thereafter has pursued postgraduate training, or what's called residency training, in psychiatry, which generally is a combination of psychopharmacology or medication management to address mental health issues, but also with an extensive psychotherapy training. My training is really rooted in both traditions of kind of the biomedical model that addresses the biochemical imbalances associated with mental illness, but also the psychology behind mental illness and addressing those issues.
Can I ask you a quick question? Because my cousin is a psychiatrist. Mm-hmm. He's trying to do forensics right now, but he loves it. And he's practiced here. This is, I guess, a question for me, but he specifically practiced it in New York because he said in New York, psychiatry is more rooted in kind of like the foundation of it, I guess, for lack of a better term. And like, whereas they're not as quick to prescribe drugs, they're not as whatever. Like, I have another friend who's a psychiatrist somewhere else, and they'll like make fun of each other for prescribing kids low doses of Adderall or whatever. Like, it just seems like, is there a different philosophy in different parts of America? Is New York more rooted in the psychology of it?
There's definitely a difference in the way it's practiced.
Right.
In part, it's just because there's so many people here that you have to offer services that fill the needs across the entire spectrum. And not everyone is looking for medications.
Right.
There is a sense that psychiatry in New York is a little bit more steeped in kind of, you were referring to the foundations. By that, I assume you mean kind of psychotherapy,
exactly,
which is kind of originated by Freud and then advanced by many, many people since that time. And I would say that is true, that a good number of even the training programs here still have kind of strong connections to that.
Right.
Maybe not as much as, you know, in the past, but certainly that's a strong component of training here. And it was for mine as well.
Right.
Elsewhere in the country, I'm not quite sure why. Maybe it's in part because New York there's a strong kind of European connection kind of historically, right? Whereas elsewhere in the country, it's less so. It's a little bit more tenuous. That's just a guess. But I think another part of it is the reason that therapy has been such a significant part of life in New York is because it's a stressful place and people are just more open to it. But also we have more resources here to be able to afford that. That's not necessarily the case elsewhere.
Sorry, how would you advise people between choosing between a psychiatrist, a psychologist, a therapist?
Another good question.
We're starting off with bangs here, man. I started with a long monologue, kind of messed it up, but I'm trying to work it back.
We're on fire. We're good.
So generally speaking, many psychiatrists focus more on medications. Again, that's a generalization. There's definitely exceptions. If you are certain that you're going to need medications, say you've been in therapy for a long time and you feel like you need a little bit more help, then obviously, you would go to a psychiatrist. I guess what it ultimately comes down to is rather than choosing between a psychiatrist and a psychologist therapist, I would say you're better off looking for someone who focuses on an issue that you're really struggling with.
Oh, okay.
Rather than distinguishing between the degree the training. That is assuming medications may or may not be part of the picture.
Right.
Because a good psychologist, if they feel like you would really benefit from medications, will tell you that and refer you to a psychiatrist.
Of course.
So I think more than anything else, you want to go to the best person you can.
But that's great, because I see a lot of my friends that have, like, you know, we all have been talking about it more and more. It's the conversation of like, hey, maybe I want to go to therapy. It's hard to find what to look for. And I think knowing, hey, focus on rather than degrees or anything like that, focus on the issue is, I think, really helpful.
For instance, you know, a big area of my focus is OCD. And
right.
A good number of my patients are not on medication. I only do therapy, a very specialized type of therapy for OCD.
Oh, wow.
Which is unusual for an MD, for a psychiatrist.
Right.
But it's something I'm really passionate about.
Right.
So that's just an example of, like, if you find the right fit for you, I think is much more important than the letters at the end of their name.
So let's say someone comes in, they feel like they might be depressed. Mm-hmm. So they find someone who specializes in treating depression, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's what you're saying. Just find someone who says, I specialize in depression. And then you find that, what if you feel like they might be prescribing medicine kind of quickly or like whatever? How does the medicine thing work? Because a lot of us, I think, are slow to want to take drugs, psychotropics or whatever they're called.
Right. So that can be a tricky issue to manage, right? There are some people who are quicker to want medications than others. I think that issue is definitely worthwhile exploring in terms of, if you're seeing a professional who feels like you could benefit from medications, kind of have that conversation with them. Be very frank and ask, is it possible that we try alternatives before rushing to medications?
Okay.
But also, from my point of view, from the psychiatrist's point of view, is if someone is very adamantly against medication, that's often useful material to discuss in therapy.
Right.
Why is this such a barrier for you? What is there's usually a lot of stigma there, perhaps a lot of challenges with like control issues that often underlie difficulty kind of accepting medications, which I get. I mean, a good number of people are resistant to that.
Can we, this segues actually more beautifully into this barrier question, some of the barriers that we face around mental health. And I would love, a lot of this is universal, obviously, but this is a show about South Asian identity, and I would love to talk about barriers. The taboo around mental health.
Sure.
You know, there are a few barriers that I see. There's the barrier for actually seeking help. Then there's the shame around it, that you are needing help. And, you know, and I'm just wondering if we could talk about those barriers. Where do you, as a practitioner, feel like that comes from, and how can we address that?
Right. I think you hit the nail on the head when you kind of identify these two levels, that there's a lot of inertia in seeking help,
mm-hmm.
and then there's shame even when you are receiving the help that's needed. I think seeking help is always a challenge for many, many people, and particularly South Asians. I think a good chunk of that comes from how the community views mental illness.
It's right.
By and large, again, this is a generalization, but typically you hear of people viewing, say, depression or anxiety or some sort of disorder as a failing, you know, a moral failing, or someone just not exerting themselves enough, or someone being lazy. And there really is a lack of understanding on the part of the community about mental illness and the kind of biochemical underpinnings, that this, in many ways, is an illness no different than high blood pressure or diabetes that can be addressed in various ways. And it's not anything to vilify someone about. It's not something to blame someone about, nor is it something that you can tell someone to snap out of.
Right.
And I think part of the focus of my graduate work at Downstate was immigrant health. The more kind of salient aspect of that for me was immigrant mental health, is because there's so much awareness that needs to be brought about in order to kind of chip away at the stigma towards mental health. And big reason I'm so excited to be here is because we really need people within the community to be doing this type of outreach.
Do you feel like it's starting to shift a little bit? Like, I know Bollywood had a movie, I think it was Dear Zindagi, about going to therapy. And like, I feel like there might be the seeds of shift, I guess.
I do think that's shifting slowly. But the pace is never as quick as I would like it to be, especially when I'm sort of at the forefront and seeing patients suffering,
right?
In part because they come in and they're embarrassed. Maybe their parents don't know that they're seeing me, or they have to hide their medications, or, you know, I've heard all kinds of stories along those lines, and it's heartbreaking. And it impedes their getting better oftentimes.
What is there something that we like? What is something that we can do to help take the stigma away? I mean, is it just about talking about it and being open and like spreading exposure?
I mean, I would say. I mean, I thought your intro was great. That you can sort of.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear what happened. I'm sorry, I didn't hear that. Can you just say it a little louder in that direction?
We will talk about
You're really kind of being candid about being in therapy, which is fantastic.
Right.
Once you start opening up about that and talking about and normalizing it, a lot of the kind of the valence around it, the emotional kind of like discomfort that people have, suddenly people start relaxing around the idea of, oh, hey, this guy's, he seems like a cool and normal guy, and he's talking about being in therapy.
Right.
Maybe it's not that big a deal.
Right.
And I think having this kind of candid conversation with our friends, with our acquaintances, is really important. I mean, I've been in therapy myself for many, many years now, and I'm the first to admit it.
Right.
How has it helped you?
Well, it's on many levels. It helps me personally because I'm not immune to my own challenges,
feeling things. And let's say it's like, I feel like in the South Asian community, and maybe this isn't particular to, I'm sure it's not, but I feel it, it's like this expectation to be perfect.
Sure.
This expectation to be a superhero.
Right.
And I mean, I'll be very honest, the reason that I went to therapy was I wanted to, like, I'm only aware of this now, but I wanted to not be hurt again. So I thought I needed to fix everything so that I was like, basically I thought I needed to become Superman.
That's kind of how I would approach it now.
And I'll be honest, what I've realized is I need to allow what's been the best. Now I'm allowing myself to be a human holding space for like my emotions and my life without beating myself up, which maybe this ties into the shame thing, but I feel like this perfection thing is another barrier.
It is. It is because it's almost like admitting, again, going back to what I was saying earlier, is admitting that you have failed in some way by seeking help. That there's this idea in the community that, well, I should be able to do this on my own, and it mars me if I need help. But I think you raise a good point, and it's quite a common thing across kind of many immigrant communities. I don't think it's just a South Asian thing, but certainly very prominent in our community. When you have children of immigrants, there's very frequently a great amount of stress, a lot of pressure that's put on people.
Mm-hmm.
And I understand where it's coming from, right? I mean, it's certainly true for my parents and my friends' parents, and my patients go through this as well, that there is this sense of, we've moved here to provide a better life for you, and we want you to really like grab the bull by the horns and use every ounce of this opportunity
right.
and not to waste it. So there's a lot of pressure and put on someone.
Right.
Pressure. I feel guilty saying anything is hard, knowing what they lived in India, how hard it was to come here, how hard it was to start in a new country. I'm like, what they went through and then what I went through, I'm not going through anything.
Sure. I mean, by comparison, we certainly have it easier in some ways.
Yeah.
Although I think we can all agree, probably face a whole different slew of challenges they're not aware of.
Yeah.
And I think part of the difficulty is that we're a generation that is sort of straddling two cultures, two sets of values.
Right.
And sometimes they're not all that compatible.
Right.
And how do you reconcile that? And oftentimes these different ways of life and opposing viewpoints can really cause a lot of conflict in someone. And that conflict can manifest in ways that, you know, affect your mental well-being.
The language that we use is really important. I've never felt comfortable saying I'm depressed because I've never been clinically diagnosed, but I hear it so often, like I'm depressed today. But there's a difference between that and clinical depression, correct?
Sure, absolutely.
What language, is it problematic if we're just being casual with that term? Or
I do think it's a problem that people throw it around very loosely. Because the flip side of kind of the stigma and not wanting to acknowledge mental health issues and seek care is sort of, as you say, people kind of using it very loosely. Clinical depression is a syndrome that's characterized by a number of different symptoms, including feeling very sad for a prolonged period of time.
Right.
You know, most the diagnostic criteria are that you have to feel that way most days for an extended period of time. And right. you know, several other symptoms have to go along with it. When someone says, I feel depressed today, that almost takes away the seriousness of the issue of depression. Right. Everybody goes through periods where they are happier on some days, not as happy on other days. Our emotional lives are not stagnant, right. nor should they be. I mean, part of being human is experiencing the full range of emotions. And being down one day is, you know, usually part of the normal experience of being human. When it becomes severe, when it becomes sustained, and when it starts impairing your functioning, that's when we start calling it depression.
Well, I hear the same thing with like OCD and anxiety. I mean, anxiety in New York is like thrown around and like right. this
I hear it constantly.
It's almost like you have to be anxious to be in New York. Like it's become almost a rite of passage to say
you have anxiety.
Yeah. And same thing for us. You have to be like, oh man, he's so OCD. And it's like, how can we educate our listeners and ourselves? I mean, we'll start with ourselves about better use of that language.
Language is such an important part because it's reflective of culture, but it also influences culture. And I think it would be really important, well, first of all, to stop using it ourselves, if any of us are guilty of that, to right. kind of yeah. casually use OCD or you know, depression. As a psychiatrist, as a provider in the mental health field, I feel that it's my duty, and I do this to kind of educate people that I encounter, as saying, right. you know, everything that you experience, the need to sort of, say, organize things in a certain way that one might label OCD, feeling low one day, feeling anxious one day. All of these experiences are part of what make us human, really. They comprise mm-hmm. a very natural experience and the fullness of our emotional experiences. And really, they exist on a spectrum. And just because you experience some degree of symptoms on occasion doesn't mean you have a disorder. And I think making that distinction between the occasional symptom and having a disorder are quite different things. And it's important for people to realize that, while also acknowledging that on the flip side, we shouldn't kind of dismiss something that is very impairing as, oh, it's something that everyone experiences, which I think is the flip side
of what happens when we're so loose with the
right,
language.
Is that exactly.
Oh, that's really interesting. Part of the education is that it's an illness like high blood pressure or diabetes, right? What about, I don't have one of a disorder. I'm going to therapy because I needed help coping with life better and like coping with some of my issues that weren't disorders. That's another way of people then say, well, you don't need therapy for that. Like, just that's just like, go figure it out. Like, mm-hmm. what do you need help with that for? Which I think that was actually, I think it would have been easier for my parents had I said, like, I think I'm depressed. I think I have a disorder, because my father, he would have been like, okay, well, you go see a doctor. Mm-hmm. I think that's like an argument that I think is very effective. But for one, it's just, I need help with my day-to-day, I need help with life. You know, in India, the pressure on people, there's always suicides around exam time, right? Maybe some of those people also have a disorder, but a lot of it's just, how do I cope with the pressures of life? How can we break that barrier?
You're right that getting treatment doesn't have to be something that's reserved for people who are kind of very ill or anything like that.
Right.
All of us struggle with some issues at some point in our lives or other, and may benefit from treatment. One thing I like to illustrate as kind of a useful way to talk about how therapy is helpful,
yeah,
especially in the context of kind of the South Asian community, there's a concept known as mentalizing. Mentalizing means giving name to your feelings, your emotions. And that's something that has to be taught. It has to be taught when you're very young, and so usually the job falls on parents.
Right.
But it's not an intuitive thing.
Oh.
You know, for example, how would a child know that he's hungry versus he's thirsty? How would he know to express that? He has to be taught that, the distinction between the two. Right? He has to be given the language for that.
Right.
And once you develop the repertoire of being able to express what that is, what all the various sort of experiences, inner experiences are, and how do you externalize that, it's only then that you can sort of begin to do something about the inner experience that you know, if it's distressing, it's only then that you can do something about it. Or even if it's a good experience, it's, you can then share it with someone when you have the language to do that. In my experience, and this is, again, not just a South Asian thing, but it is a common in the South Asian community, parents don't necessarily teach children how to mentalize, how to identify their emotions.
Mm.
You know, for instance, a young child comes home and is sort of huffing and puffing, throws his bag on the floor. The mentalizing response to that is, what's wrong? Mm-hmm. You know, you want to ask your child, what is your inner experience? And let me help you label that and find a label for it if you don't already have it, so we can do something about it.
Right.
In my experience, and in a lot of the South Asians that I know, you know, their experience, the response sometimes doesn't match what they're going through. It'll be, oh, what did you have for lunch today? I mean, how many times have we heard, you know, there's like the emphasis on food, which is important, right? It's nourishment.
Right. But it's like, we don't talk about that.
Right.
Let's not talk about
that. Right. There's sort of a concreteness to, like, I'm going to nourish you physically and that's what matters.
Right.
But the message that sends is that I can't talk about this distress that I'm feeling. I can only talk about this thing. Only certain things are permitted to be talked about.
Yeah.
Which brings me back to your question of how can therapy help people that are maybe don't feel clinically depressed or have kind of a syndrome. Well, one really invaluable skill you learn in therapy is how to mentalize. If you haven't already learned that, we take these inabilities with us into adulthood, which sounds super easy, right? Like you just name what you're feeling. But really, like in the moment when you're distressed,
it's tough.
Sometimes it's really hard to pinpoint and be like, you know, I'm feeling angry because of this and that that you have done.
Personal thing I realized through therapy, sometimes my temper is crazy.
Mm-hmm.
And then I read a book on rage because of it, because it was really like, you know, I'm not breaking anything or calling any names or hurting anybody, but it was just like, I wasn't fully in control. And a lot of it, what my therapist brought up was like, it seems like there's always this common theme of being disrespected. And then I read this book and it's called Shame-Based Rage, which is like, I feel like I'm being disrespected because I feel this low self-worth. And so when I think someone's disrespecting me, it's actually that shame being like, oh fuck, I don't want to feel this.
Sure.
Just get mad at this person to cope. So
misdirected.
Yeah. So through mental, I'm able to mentalize through therapy and through reading this book of, oh, that's now like, if I feel like I'm being disrespected, I'm like, okay, that's actually just me thinking I'm not good enough. That's what I need to deal with, as opposed to just fuck this person.
That's brilliant. Right. And you can stave the sort of dramatic response.
Yeah. And it's still there, but like, I can try to calm it down a little bit and be like, all right, that's not about this guy. It's about you.
And I think the important thing to realize about therapy is that the idea isn't to do away with negative emotions.
Mm.
We're human beings. We're always going to have negative emotions. It's about how to deal with them in a healthier way.
Right.
They say this in meditation, how to skillfully manage and skillfully navigate.
I was wondering if I could ask two questions.
Please.
Number one, I always hear it said by therapists, and I believe it, everybody should go to therapy. At what age do you think people should start going to therapy? Because I think an eight-year-old, that I don't know how much that's really going to do if they don't have problems. And two, I asked my cousin this, who's a psychiatrist. He gave me a lot of advice when I was seeking a therapist. I said, it seems like about half the people I know who go into therapy come out and they're truly grown up and they're truly impacted and they seem different as they're going to therapy. The other half of people I know walk out the exact same person they were when they walked in. And he said, well, people don't get this, but people don't understand this, but you get out of therapy what you put into therapy. It's work. And I don't really know what that means. I didn't want to admit that at the time. What does that mean? And then also the age question.
To your first point, I don't think that everyone needs to go to therapy.
Okay.
I think very many people could benefit from therapy. There's no doubt about that.
Right.
But by no means is it a universal necessity.
Right.
And so by extension, I don't think there's the right age.
Right.
Issues manifest at various ages. And at that point, you can sort of figure out when is the appropriate time. Your second question was the work involved in therapy and people who sort of maybe don't benefit as much because they don't put the work in.
And I think some people have the idea that I just go and I get to complain to this person for an hour.
Right.
And I'm good.
And I'll bring it back to what you said earlier about the acknowledging the shame basis of your rage.
Right.
That took work to get there.
Yeah.
right?
Which I try to know what that means, right. Ask myself questions or whatever, but I guess as maybe it's an Indian thing, but I want some concrete work I can do.
Right.
Because we're just so driven about like even an improvement, I'm very driven. And what concrete steps can I take?
Right. Someone who goes and vents once a week.
Yeah.
But when he experiences, let's again, to kind of make it concrete and use your example, doesn't ask himself the question of what's going on here when he's angry.
Right.
Isn't doing the work that might benefit him ultimately. And that's what it means. It means that there is reflection and kind of introspection that is required between sessions when you're in therapy.
Right.
Like just the going an hour a week isn't going to do anything. It's really, you know,
it's the time in between.
That kind of, I view that hour as kind of, it anchors you and grounds you and sets the stage for what the next sort of the upcoming week will look like.
It's like going to class and then doing the homework.
Precisely.
Right.
Oh, and, wow. And, by the way, there's very many different modalities of therapy, which we haven't even gotten into. And
right.
Some of them are far more structured and actually have homework assigned to them,
right.
Like logs, diaries, that sort of thing. It really is very kind of condition and person specific.
Mm-hmm.
So sometimes the work can be much more concrete than just reflection and introspection. It's actually writing stuff down.
Right.
There's two topics I want to bring up before we lose too much time. You, in your introduction, is culturally competent. That phrase comes up several times within your introduction. It's not a phrase I had heard before. I would love for you to speak to what that means and why that's important to you. And then there's another issue that I think about a lot within the South Asian culture in specific, issues with sexuality. And not just whether you're gay or straight, but issues of sexual repression, what's allowed, like, is it okay to masturbate, like the issues of like what's allowed and what's not. And I feel like those are two areas that maybe there's not a tie-in, but I'm wondering if there is, or if there's just two separate topics that we want to talk about. But those are the two things I'm interested in right now.
So your first question about culturally competent care has been, I think, on people's radars for a number of years now. Certainly was, you know, when I was in graduate school and first became kind of aware of this idea that the delivery of healthcare is not a one-size-fits-all model.
Right.
You know, there is growing recognition of the fact that mental illness doesn't take place in the same way across different environments. Even in the same environment, it'll manifest differently in different people. But more broadly, there's a lot of variability in terms of how mental health symptoms emerge in various cultures. And this is not just kind of different ethnicities, by the way. Even kind of within the U.S., right. In various cities, there's kind of more subtle variabilities. But once you start going across cultures, there can be very significant variabilities. And even across time, there can be so many different ways in which it's expressed. If you look at the sort of hysterical paralysis that was so common in sort of 19th century Europe when Freud was was first kind of putting forth his theories and developing psychodynamic psychotherapy, that was something that was reflective of how repressive society was for women at the time.
Right.
You don't see hysterical paralysis really at all anymore, because
that's true.
And it is reflective of what's happening in society for women.
Oh, wow.
Likewise, I mean, we bring it to a South Asian context, you often see that because of the shame and stigma associated with acknowledging being depressed, perhaps things that people sort of view as Western illnesses incorrectly. Oftentimes, there's a much more of a kind of somatic way of expressing psychic stress. And what I mean by that is that people will experience anxiety and depression as like being tired or feeling sick. Or my favorite thing that kind of many cross-cultural psychiatrists are now becoming aware of is gas. I mean, people say like, oh yeah, he has gas, when they refer to sort of a stomach pain.
Oh yeah.
Which, sure, might happen on occasion, but quite frankly, gas doesn't really cause the amount of pain and debilitation to the extent that our community attributes to it. So I think there's a very significant psychic component to experiencing pain, which, by the way, doesn't make it less real. This is real pain that people experience, but it's very difficult for them to say, I'm depressed, so I'm going to stay home. So instead, they might be like, I'm not really not doing well. My stomach is upset. And those are ways that culture influences the way mental illness manifests. Hmm. It's okay. Not just...
So this is coming back to the... It's so for you as a practitioner, is it about training within that culture? Does that mean that you should seek out a practitioner that is of your culture?
I don't know that it's necessary to seek out a practitioner that is of your culture. I mean, if the primary issue has to do with
cultural
identity and acculturation, it may help. But I honestly think that any good mental health provider can really do a good job of understanding what the issues are once they get to know you.
Okay.
It might maybe speed things up if there's some familiarity already is the only thing that I could see kind of influencing it. In some cases, people have a hard time going to kind of ethnically concordant providers in the sense that if you and your psychiatrist are from the same community, maybe there's a little bit more you hold back because there's shame and what if they know people I know? That's certainly something I've heard.
Right.
And for other people, there's a degree of comfort associated with that. So I don't think there's a right or wrong about that. Segueing into your second point about sometimes these conflicts and these expressions of challenges and kind of what's going on internally, or it's hard to express it fully. The basis of that can be so many things. It can be things like we were talking about earlier, sort of straddling two different cultures. What if your values and your desires are really different from what you're expected to perform? What if your goals are different from what your parents expect of you? There's a very profound conflict I see.
Not having those line up.
Right, not having those line up. Having that be different. And how do you reconcile that?
Right.
How do you feel like you're a good person and a good son or daughter or whatever, but still be able to pursue the goals you want, still be able to live the life that you want? Sometimes that can apply to sexuality.
Mm-hmm.
That can apply to relationships. I mean, across the board.
It's all the same. It's all still rooted in these same...
Conflict. The underlying thing for a lot of these issues that come up is conflict between inner desires and sort of externally what you're allowed to express within the culture.
It's a beautiful way of putting it. We want to move to our stupid questions segment just because it's stupid questions. But we like to end this, and this might be difficult with mental health, but is there a tangible, practical, or something that our listeners can do tonight, tomorrow, right after they've listened to this episode, to help their mental health? Is that something that you can offer?
I would say that we were talking earlier about kind of the work that's involved between therapy sessions is introspection and reflection. And I would say that before you go to bed tonight, give yourself some time and some space for some serious reflection on your emotional life. Are there things that you are really kind of not happy about? Are you going through kind of profound sadness or anxiety or anger or, you know, whatever the situation might be that you feel is hampering your growth as a human being? And if you are, maybe consider doing something about that.
But that's beautiful. Yeah. That's so, like, it's such a simple thing that anyone can do. It doesn't cost any money. It's just take some time to reflect. I love that.
We often neglect it. It's the first thing that kind of gets swept under the rug is how you're feeling inside whatever. We are very quick to dismiss our feelings because, again, it's sort of not something that is necessarily encouraged in our community.
It's not encouraged. I feel like there's so many ways that I can distract myself. I used to wake up every morning in New York and I would be aware of all of these feelings. Like, the morning's the rich time for me to be aware of a lot. And then I would walk out the door And because of just all the stimulation around, I just would forget about, sure. I just would be distracted. So I wouldn't deal with it. Like, I wouldn't confront any of it.
Right.
I didn't have to.
Right. You don't have to. You don't have to leave the door at all. Leave your home at all. Pick up your phone.
Right, exactly.
So like turn on one of 50 screens that I'm sure we all have at home.
Right.
And there's endless distraction. So yes, put all that away. Close your eyes if it'll help. And really just look within.
I love that. Guys, stupid questions.
Well, let's do it. So stupid questions. If you haven't listened before.
Because you're a terrible person.
Yeah, which I understand. Not many people listen. but it's some people might have questions about a topic that they are afraid to ask because they're afraid it's a stupid question. We have no fear of being stupid. We will ask that question. And we're going to pepper in a couple of questions that we know are stupid, but we... It's way more fun to be ignorant than informed. You guys should really take that note. It'll help your mental health. Anyway.
We'll start with this one. How much do prescriptions affect me? Will they change my personality if I take them? Will I become a zombie?
I actually get that question a ton. There are so many different categories of medications that we have to use that there's no really one way to say how medication is going to affect a person. And this is both in terms of its intended as well as its adverse effects. Any medication has both good and bad things associated with it. It's just a matter of weighing the risks and the benefits. Oftentimes, when someone is seeking a medication or just seeking any kind of mental health care, my job is to help them weigh those risks and benefits and really kind of understand, well, what do you want to achieve out of this treatment, and what might you be willing to potentially risk? And I don't mean to say, you know, you kind of ask the question of will you turn into a zombie?
Well, there's this conception among artists especially, right?
Right.
You know, there's this idea that if Picasso had been on Zoloft, that he would not have gone through his blue period, or like these are somewhat facetious joke, but in the art community, there is a bit of a negative association with some of these medications,
mm-hmm.
and I would love for you to speak to that.
I mean, I understand the fear associated with that,
right?
Because oftentimes going through kind of very intense feelings for many artists are associated with some of their most profound works. I get it. But it kind of goes back to what I was saying earlier, is all these symptoms exist on a spectrum, and if you're feeling these feelings, but are able to kind of manage them in a way that doesn't require medications and you're still able to function, that might be okay.
Right.
The problem becomes when people are not able to function because of these profound symptoms, or perhaps not function to the extent that they want to. So again, it's a very individual decision as to whether a medication works or not for someone, or would be beneficial or not for someone.
But whether you won't become a zombie. That's what I'm hearing.
You won't become a zombie.
How long until I feel a difference with therapy?
Oh, boy.
Oh.
That is my most loathed question.
Right.
Because
that's why we asked it.
I know. it's impossible to answer that because, again, there's so many different conditions. There's so many different modalities of therapy. As an example, for the type of therapy I do for OCD, it's very structured.
Right.
There's homework assigned between. And if you kind of do everything and you're kind of systematic about things and you're diligent with the work, oftentimes I see very significant results in 3 to 4 months, which is not a very long amount. I mean, people often think that they have to be in therapy for years and years and years to see any change. And I mean, it really is kind of very case to case, right? So that's kind of on the shorter end of things, 3 to 4 months. There's also a lot of other issues. It depends, like if there's much more deep-seated issues that are kind of rooted in our childhood experiences. And sometimes even uncovering those can take months or even years.
I mean, it took me 6 months to even be comfortable and safe enough with my therapist to start bringing up stuff.
Right.
And then it took another 2 years. Some stuff just took
a long
time.
That's also something, I don't know if you need to prepare people for it, if you're listening and you start therapy. The first part is intense. My first session, my therapist commented, I was kind of holding the chair, bracing myself for the entire hour.
Mm-hmm.
And then I walked out of there feeling like someone went inside and moved every emotion around. And I just walked out like, what the fuck just happened?
I mean, it's not uncommon for people to either feel that's sort of your suddenly like the pot's been stirred. This is not what I'm used to.
Right.
Or oftentimes in early stages of therapy, it'll be pretty superficial. Hmm. It's right. like you're barely scratching the surface until right. there's that comfort there.
Right. Right.
I mean, as an example, I mentioned I'm in treatment myself, going on 15-ish years, and I'm still discovering things about myself and right. still making improvements every time. So it's all about what your goals are and matching the treatment with your
right.
goals.
Right.
True or false? If I go to therapy, it means something's wrong with me.
I'm laughing because it's true or false.
It's
a stupid question.
There you go. Got one.
It's also true. but there's a lot of people who have something wrong with them, right?
If there's nothing wrong with you, then good for you. Why are you in therapy, right? I mean, I feel like I've yet to meet someone with whom there's nothing wrong.
Yeah.
Just everybody from A to Z has ways in which they can improve.
Okay, last question. If I go to therapy, will I cry all the time?
Well, I have had patients cry in therapy. I've had patients laugh like out loud in therapy. It really is the full spectrum of emotions that emerges when you're digging deep and you're digging into places that you're not accustomed to digging. So yeah, you're going to feel all kinds of emotions, and that's a good thing.
Yeah, but like outside of therapy, you know what I mean? Where it's embarrassing.
I cry a lot more now, man.
I really do. Post love and therapy, I mean, it's...
I think it's beautiful, though.
Yeah, that's what you think.
It is beautiful. Don't listen to Akash. That's the lesson. You really want to improve your mental health, don't listen to Akash Singh.
That's not a bad idea, actually. It's not bad advice, to be honest.
Naveen, we want to thank you so much for coming on the show.
And truly.
This is really beautiful.
Oh, it's been my pleasure.
Is there a way people can, like, I don't know, do you want to be found by the listeners of American Daisies?
Oh, I'd be happy to if they'd like to reach out. My website is DarganiMD, DarganiMD.com.
Guys, beautiful. Check it out. Fill a contact form, tell him how amazing he was on American Daisies.
And if you're feeling anxious right now, if you're feeling sad right now, if you're feeling lost and helpless, like you don't know what's going on, rate the podcast 5 stars. You'll feel much better. It really has a way of centering you and making you feel settled and like working out some issues.
It's really how you mentalize.
Yeah.
It's
a beautiful form of mentalization.
This is your homework. This is your structured homework for your mental health. We're coming back next week, so definitely tune in. Very excited. We're going to be diving into meditation. So we hope to catch you all then. I'm Arjun.
I'm Akash.
Catch you guys then.
God bless.